I'm Steve Bijou. Welcome to Down Home Corner. We're running the roads in this episode. Byron Christopher will join me from Edmonton, Alberta, and we'll introduce you to Sam Bell, who'll join us from Maryland, USA. Byron, you know from the previous episodes of the show, and you can listen again at downhomecorner.com, by the way. Byron, of course, is a national award-winning journalist and originally from Campbellton, New Brunswick. He's covered extensively the story of Richard Lee McNair, the escaped convict captured by RCMP in Campbellton in 2007. Byron's six-part series, The Running Man, won a national newspaper award for both him and the Campbellton Tribune, the paper's first national award. Byron went on to write The Man Who Mailed Himself Out of Jail, releasing it in both electronic book, online, and eventually paperback, which is now available on Amazon.ca. The latest venture is a four-part series released on Discovery Plus, called The Prison Breaker. In this, Byron showcases it and is also executive producer of the TV series. Sam Bell is with us today because he knew Richard McNair back in 1985 when he was stationed in Minot, North Dakota, and is a current pen pal of McNair's. He worked in law enforcement for decades, nearly 20 years as a government contractor, and has recently returned to the private sector. All three of us have watched the TV series and know the book, of course, but here's the twist. We aren't here to praise the series. To be quite blunt, we're all three a little disappointed. And coming up, you'll hear why. So, let me introduce to you Sam Bell, joining us from Maryland, USA, and welcome back to the show, Byron Christopher, on the line from Edmonton, Alberta. Well, I just think it would be kind of interesting to kind of compare the series from three different perspectives is all. Unfortunately, Sam's about the only possibility of anybody I'm going to get even remotely connected to law enforcement. So I think that would be really interesting to get all three of our perspectives kind of discussing the series sort of thing in just, you know, generalities, so to speak. But Sam, if you could just kind of qualify where or your knowledge of Richard Lee McNair is from.
Okay, I was stationed at Minot. I arrived there in June of 1983. I was, back then, the security police career field was split. I was law enforcement. We were the actual police. We just stayed on base, and then Richard was a security specialist. And then they were broken down between aircraft security, who either guarded the planes or the bomb dump on base, and the missile security. And that's what Richard did. And I met him through a missile cop that I'd been processed with, and kind of fell out of touch with him. And I remember seeing the video of Richard and Officer Bordelain there outside of the prison. And as soon as I saw that face and that grin, I was like, gosh, I know that guy. And then I read Byron's ebook and connected with him. I said, how can I get in touch with this guy? And that was, what, probably 10 plus years ago. And wrote to Richard. I said, hey, you know, we knew each other through Kurt. I won't bring his last name up. And immediately, because this guy, Kurt, every time he saw you, he's like, yo, Pard, how's it going? And we immediately, you know, just started going down memory lane. And, you know, we're exchanging letters quite a bit. And then now we can send the, I don't know if you can classify them as emails, but, you know, that's a lot easier to do. And Byron sent me a copy of the printed book last year, and I happened to be unemployed at the time. So I literally just went through that book in like 2 days. I just couldn't put it down. Mm-hmm. And when he committed the crimes in North Dakota, I was stationed in Wyoming, and I honestly don't recall ever hearing about it. I mean, Wyoming was not that far away from North Dakota, but I just honestly never heard about it.
Okay, so that's your connection to
yes,
Richard McNair, and through the book, and thank you for the nice words.
Yeah,
Steve, you've read the book as well. You've also had the advantage of seeing the documentary series, as has Mr. Bell. Does anything jump out at you, or where are you coming from on this?
Well, being from Camelton, New Brunswick, the first thing that pops out at me is a couple of the geographical gaffes that come up in the series where Camelton or the surrounding area, Atholville and Tidehead and those kind of things, end up in spots that are supposed to be Kentucky at one point and then Penticton, B.C. on the other. So I guess in one way, I'm happy that the exposure is to Camelton, but not happy that it's been mislabeled, so to speak, you know. But, you know, hey, no animals were harmed in the mislabeling of that footage, as far as I can tell. So, but, you know, I mean, like, it's, you know, it's maybe a little much ado about nothing, but it's kind of hits me in the credibility nerve, so to speak. It's, I don't know, Sam would be like, if you're questioning somebody and all of a sudden they say something that doesn't seem accurate and everything up to that point seemed like it was accurate, you know, like it gives you, like your antenna goes up, so to speak. That's where it starts with me, the mistrust type of thing. And it's not, and I don't want to use that with a capital M mistrust, but I start going, okay, are you getting this right, you know? And then, you know, and then I start wondering about some of the other people that are being interviewed in the special, you know, and having read the book and knowing a lot of the backgrounds to the story already, as well as some of the Camelton stories that Byron and I have shared, you know, it makes me wonder. But the biggest part of it all, like I keep hearing a generality with most of the people in either in law enforcement or the psychological expert that's in there, you know, bringing in his point of view, and they keep talking about McNair being this psychopath kind of guy, and I keep thinking, well, where yeah. is the pattern? If he's a psychopath, show it to me, because maybe I'm missing it, and maybe I'm being conned by the con type of thing, you know. But I don't see it. I see it as somebody who did a very terrible act that he seems to have tried to make amends for, to a certain degree at least. I'm sure the families would disagree with that. But, you know, it seems like, does the one bad, terrible incident define the person, you know? And I guess coming around to that long little preamble, What do you think of that, Sam? Does that make sense?
I almost sat there. My wife and I watched all of them back to back, and I've told her about Richard before. And every time the episode would end, I sat there. I said, you know, I do better jobs with my YouTube channel, with my magnet fishing and metal detecting stuff. It almost was like a comedy. And the thing that jumped out to me was the so-called psychiatrist that allegedly, and you know, Byron and I talked about this yesterday, read letters from Richard that he formed his own diagnosis on him. And I'm thinking, what is he, a witch doctor or something? How in the world can you read a person's letters, never speak to them face to face, read the body language and whatnot, can make a determination? Maybe they were on a cheap budget and he was the cheapest psychiatrist they could get. But you know, that, and then the lady that Byron and I talk about, it's like, where did these people come from? Did they not even do the slightest bit of background checks, you know, do any type of investigation on their own?
So Byron weighing in here. Yeah, that is what shocked me. What neither of you know is that the owner of the TV production company, whose name is Soledad O'Brien, she and I had an agreement that we would both have final say on the product. Okay. Of course, when it came to signing the contract, they couldn't put that in there, but of course she owns the company, so she could override that. But that never happened. And as as I saw the first draft, I saw these other people on camera talking about details that they could have only have gotten from the book. And I assumed that they were correctional law enforcement or prison guards, because they were not identified on the drafts that I saw. I was shocked to hear that they were reporters, former reporters. And then I did background checks and found out that in their stories, they did not discuss those details because they didn't know about them. So how the hell does that come about? And that's the question I had for the producers in New York. Could you show me the raw tapes of these interviews? I'd love to get to the part where you say, wow, you've got all this information. What is your source? Because in the stories you've done, you don't mention it. How does that happen? So, in other words, these people were coached. Two problems there. One, as a reporter, you would never say stuff that someone else got, and you would never be instructed. And second, the producers, genuine producers, would never ask anyone to say this and say that. Now you're an expert. That's just bullshit. So that annoyed me, and it really disappointed me, because there are a lot of reporters out there who covered the McNair story, and a lot of, to be fair, were given false leads, such as the woman from Calgary. She was told that he was in Calgary, when in fact he was in New Brunswick. And it was no fault of hers, and no fault of the police. It was a false sighting. But when you do these stories, it does not make you an expert on how he escaped, especially since you never wrote to McNair, had no contact with him at all. So suddenly here you are on camera and the expert giving details of an escape that you knew nothing about.
Yeah, just to explain who this is.
Bad journalism.
To explain who this is, Byron, for those who aren't familiar who we're talking about, we're talking about Sherry Zickfuss.
Worked for the Calgary Herald and is described as a crime blogger. That was one of the little concessions the producers made when I complained about that. I said, you know, and they told me it was a mistake having her there. And I said, okay, what's the corrective action? Well, they changed her from being a reporter to a crime blogger. And my response is, are you kidding me? She's done 103 entries on her blog. One has to do with McNair, and that was 12 years ago. How could she be an authority on this figure? Now, that's a problem I have with that. And the other one is the former CNN reporter, who, according to the owner, Soledad O'Brien, is a good friend.
Susan Rosgen, you're referring to.
Yeah, that's correct, yeah. And I haven't done any research on her. I don't know if you have, Steve, but I don't know anything about the gal. But nonetheless, she's there giving details, and I'm sure she didn't know about it at the time, but she got from the book or was told what to say.
Well, did you get that impression, Sam? That's the impression I got, and I don't know if you felt the same way, but I'm just wondering, having read the book as well as seen the series, the same as myself, I'm wondering if you got that same impression, if that they just kind of got pieces out of the book and read it, because they weren't really part of the coverage of the story in either real time or shortly afterwards. Am I right?
It reminded me almost like it was a movie, and they had a script, and that's what they went from, because I'm sitting here going, did they even bother to investigate, to read? You know, I never was a newsman, but you always verify your sources. You always want more than one source. And it just seemed like this thing was just thrown together. And I was pretty disgusted with the last half of the fourth episode, because that was like dump on Richard. And I mean, at the end of the day, he escaped three times. He made the Federal Bureau of Prisons look like fools. And, you know, I was always taught, you know, if you make a mistake, you learn from it. And, you know, the inconsistencies with how he got out on the pallet. And I'm sitting there watching that footage with the forklift, and I'm going, yeah, would they have that type of forklift? Because I have years of experience in warehousing. And it just... the whole thing just seemed like it was a hatchet job against him. And, you know, I'm not saying that because I know the guy, I've been writing to him, but even my wife got done. She's like, gosh, I can't believe they did that to that man.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
you know, there has to be some sort of an agenda. Why would they have done that? You know, what was their purpose of that? Because I asked Byron yesterday, okay, so who's going to be the next person? Because I got the impression this was going to be a series. And it never was. And there was another show Byron had told me about a year or two ago, and it was about escapees. And Richard, I think, was like the last person that they covered. And they didn't do a terrible job on him.
That was called History Channel.
That's right. They didn't really even cover him that much. But, you know, they never bashed him that bad. And... you know, the whole thing, he shot two people, he killed one. The rest of the time, the two times he escaped, he was on a lamp, never committed any violent acts. Yeah, I laughed. I watched or listened to your podcast from earlier or last year, and I laughed about the story with the van, because Richard, you know, in the book, he was talking about how that preacher's wife's picture on the visor, it bothered him, her looking at him, and he felt so guilty that he stole this man's van. And I, correct me if I'm wrong, Byron, the guy never replaced that broken wing window, did he?
No, he did not, no.
In he left fact, it alone, and I think he did something just to jury-rig to keep the door locked. And right. I like the part you said he's going to hang on to it because they'll need it when they make the movie.
That's right, that's his van, yeah. Yeah, there was just a drawback of it. When they're interviewing the U.S. Marshal, the initial drafts had Richard McNair breathing through a tiny plastic tube.
Right.
And he's describing that. And I called the U.S. Marshal, and I said, Glenn, that's not correct. He was breathing through a larger tube that was made of cardboard, pressed cardboard. That carpet in the prison had arrived wrapped up in this tube. That's what he's breathing through. It'd be impossible for him to breathe through a tiny little plastic tube. He'd suffocate. So Glenn said, yeah, that's right. We found that in there, and it was obviously his snorkel that he had planned to use if he was underwater. Okay, I get that. So what do? They took him out. They took out the part about him saying he was breathing through the plastic tube, but they continued to use the footage of it, giving the impression he was breathing through this tiny tube. It's a minor point, but what it shows more important is dishonesty. They knew that was not correct, and they kept it in there. And they knew these reporters didn't know the facts. And in fact, if you watch them carefully, they finish their statements, and they look at the camera as if to say, did I get it right? They lack a connection to the story. Now, you won't find that with the father. You won't find it with me, with Carolyn, the girlfriend. You won't find it with any of the police officers. But you do with the two talking heads, we call them. They're fakes. And they come across as fakes because they're being told what to say. And that, to me, is so disappointing. I never had final say in spite of the promise. I was not told who they were interviewing. I had no idea. Was not consulted in any of these other talking heads. And by the time they interviewed him, it was a bit too late. You know, the gate was open. These people were out there. I mean, they've modified it a bit, and that's nothing but appeasement. But there was no real corrective action taken. That's why I rate it as a 3 out of 10. The archival footage is good. The officers who spoke and the father, Carolyn, you know, it's all good. It's real. And some of the quotes by McNair is another beef were not even accurate. Mm-hmm. They had him laughing behind some of the statements that never existed. And I corrected some of it, but other stuff they just left on. So they seem to do what they want to do. They seem to have an agenda, which was why why I was not involved early on. Normally, if you got a producer, they'll phone you up and say, Byron, this is where we're going with this. What do you think? You know, you're really involved in it. They kept me in the dark until they did the drafts, and by then it was a bit too late. I complained about it, and they've made some modifications. But in the end, as Steve Bijou pointed out, there's some geographical gaffes there showing aerial shots of Campbellton that they claim is Penticton, British Columbia, 3,100 miles away. They not only did that once, but twice. And they have another shot that he's off to Kentucky, and that's right there in the story. He leaves Tennessee and he's off to Kentucky, and they show a picture of Highway 11.
Highway 11, yeah.
I mean, that's true. It's another gaffe.
I'm going. Kentucky has a Sugarloaf. Look at that, man! Look at that right there. There's a Sugarloaf, and there's they have an exit and a mill the same as Campbellton. Yeah. Wow. You know, yeah.
So I see all these mistakes, and as someone pointed out to me, well, okay, they got those mistakes. What else did they screw up?
Mm.
And of course, they're not privy to the production process, But I can tell you they messed up on a few things.
Absolutely. But the one thing that you got a chance to do in your book, Byron, and Sam, you brought this up earlier, and I want to bring this up, although I have talked about it in an earlier podcast. And thank you for listening to a previous podcast, by the way, Sam. But was the story and the sad saga of Colonel Bordelon. I don't want to sound overdramatic, but my goodness, that story had a bad effect and a terrible effect on a human being like that. You know, I mean, the video is, of course, you know, it's used in the beginning of the each episode of the series, and I get it. It's pretty dramatic, and it's, you know, that's how we all got introduced to this story, for sure. But, I mean, poor Officer Bordelon. He got thrown under the bus, I think, in the series by the law enforcement and by the U.S. Marshals. I thought that he certainly got the short end of the stick, and I'm glad that Byron at least was able to make contact with Officer Bordelon over the years, and at least maybe kind of ease some of that pain that he went through. I mean, how do you live with, you know, worldwide millions and millions and millions of people seeing you as the guy that let the bad guy get away, you know?
Sam, how did you see that? How did you see Bordelon portrayed there? What's your view on
it? That almost brought me to tears, because I knew the poor man passed away. He had a heart attack. He was actually 3 years younger than me when I had my heart attack.
Did you know him personally?
No. I never met him. I actually think that's how I got onto the story, was to see the camera footage,
right?
The dash cam. And like they were saying in the video, that, or the so-called documentary, that, you know, Richard approached him several times in a menacing fashion. He never did. Richard was completely relaxed. The officer never turned his strong side with his weapon away. I never got the impression. And the little joke they made about Richard using, you know, Jimmy, and then I forget the other name. Well, I'm not technically from the South, but my last duty station, I worked with Cajuns, and that's common down there. You know, it's common in the South, the people, you know, Billy Bob, Jimmy Joe, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
If you aren't from country, you wouldn't have picked up on it. And, you know, Byron told me the story about when he met the officer, and the man was just extremely defensive. And, you know, I was glad that Richard was able to contact him and, you know, make amends. But that poor man, you know, he was just a laughingstock. And to hear the federal marshal berate him like that, and that's unfortunate with law enforcement. You have, you know, the state law enforcement looks down on your town and the county and whatnot, but, you know, they beat that poor man to death over that. And the mugshot that they had, it was a crappy, grainy picture. Wasn't even accurate. You know, like Byron had said, you know, they claimed he had scars and whatnot. And like I was telling my friend that Byron sent in a book to, Richard studied maps of the area. That's how he had his story down pat. And, you know, boom, he was able to recite, oh, I'm staying over here, we're doing a roofing job here. And he wasn't stumbling, he wasn't stammering or anything. And when a person's lying, they will look up and to the left. Whereas if they're telling the truth, they look up and to the right. And I'm sure that officer had that training. He looked at Richard's body language. He was completely relaxed. And, you know, it was just a shame. And, you know, hopefully that man went to his grave not beating up on himself, that, you know, oh, I let Richard McNair free.
I did interview Bordelon, and he was not only very defensive, he was very sad. Of all the people I've interviewed, never mind those I've met, he had to be the saddest looking man I've ever met. It just broke my heart to watch him sitting there on the chair. It looked as though he'd been up all night crying about something. Aww. And that was over more than a year after the incident on the tracks, maybe 2 years or more. So I watched this man sit on the chair, his hands and fingers curling the armrests, and wondering what I would say in anticipation of the knife going in him. So when I did say that I was there to do a book on Richard Lee McNair, he just said right off the bat, I'm not interested in, unless there's a lot of money for it. And that was his compensation was to be paid. I said, the publisher won't agree to that. And he used his hands the way an umpire would at home plate to determine if someone was safe. He just moved his hands back and forth and said, I'm not interested, not interested. And standing behind him was the mayor of Ball, and to Bordelon's left was the town secretary sitting there on a love seat, taking this all in, making notes. So I walked toward him. His arms were folded over his chest. And I said, just tell me one thing. Were you afraid? Some people in town say you knew that was McNair and you were scared, and that's why you acted that way. Well, that hit a raw nerve. He immediately stiffened up and said, no, have you not seen the video? See how casual I am? And he lit right into me. But it was a good question to ask, because he didn't stop talking for more than an hour. And at the end of that chat, he just poured out all his feelings and wanted the facts, and he just let me have it. That's okay. And then he said, this is funny, you're an interesting guy. Can we talk tomorrow morning? I said hardly a word. And I said, sure. We can. What time are you into work? He said 8 o'clock. I said I'll be here before you.
And Byron's hearing sure confession. Enough, he's hearing confession there, Sam. It's like, wow.
And anyway, we had a good talk, and he opened up a lot more, and I recorded it.
Wow.
And he told me that a lot of people had made fun of him because of that. He said he pointed to a tour bus arriving outside the Ball City Hall.
Oh, man.
And all these tourists got off. They're from Asia. And he said, I bet you everyone or most of them know who I am, he said to a friend there.
Aww.
And I said, okay. That showed the impact it had on him that it was worldwide.
Poor guy,
and
man.
I said, a lot of people have ridiculed you because of that. But let me read to you comments by someone who doesn't ridicule you. And the writer just said it was a hot day and guy was wearing heavy equipment and that he was an effective victim of ridicule. In fact, he was not to be blamed for it. And Bordelon looked up. He was tapping his pencil on the desk at the time. He looked up and he smiled. He said, that's nice. Who wrote that? I said, Richard Lee McNair.
Whoa.
And his face dropped, and I tossed a letter at him. I said, read it for yourself.
Wow.
And he read it, and he said, I hope he means it. And I said, I believe he does. But, you know, it said something about McNair, I suppose, that he would say that. He could have jumped on the bandwagon with everybody else and crapped on the guy, but he chose not to. He chose to defend him, where law enforcement chose to be opportunistic and crap on him as well. So, but you don't hear the police down there say, yeah, we screwed up. He beat our dragnet, you know. He jumped a train. That was the story they gave. Well, that was not correct. No trains ran that day. That was all BS. The reason he beat their dragnet is that he was clever. Mm. He buried himself in the dirt. Even the bloodhounds couldn't find him. No, well, actually, they did. In a sense, they knew he was under a bush, but the handlers pulled the bloodhounds away. So McNair had outsmarted him, but you don't hear the cops talk about that.
No, they don't.
They just say, even in the documentary, he's left and suddenly he's up in Monroe stealing a car. So what happened to the bloodhounds? What happened to the trains that never existed, that never left that day? Police were telling reporters that McNair jumped a freight train.
He ran right so fast that the hounds couldn't catch him. Yeah. It sounds like a song, doesn't it?
Yeah. it does. Yeah. But in fact, it never happened.
Exactly.
They knew that no trains left that day. Yeah. It was all BS. They were not out to protect the public. They're out to protect their images, their image. And sorry for going on there, Sam. Does any of that make sense to you?
Oh, it does. And, you know, so basically the whole town turned against that officer then. And that's a shame, because I grew up in a small town and, you know, people can be extremely negative. And, you know, I just really hope that his last days that, you know, he had a better impression of himself. He didn't beat up on himself, because from what I get on the video, he was a big guy. And, Richard's very fit, but I think he was a lot larger officer than he's a lot bigger than Richard. And I never, ever, I watched that video countless times, well before this document, well before I read your book. And I never saw him feeding, you know, putting any space between himself and Richard. Richard just was very casual. Richard was just a very good actor. You know, he had rehearsed his story. And even my friend today that is going to get the book, he said, yeah, that guy, meaning Richard, is super intelligent. I said, yeah, he had planned this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just a shame. And I was doing a little research today about ADX Florence. And it says in there that the long-term goal is to keep USP ADX Florence, keep prisoners at ADX Florence for no more than 3 years, then to transfer them to a less restricted prison to serve the remainder of their sentences. Now, Richard's been there, what, 12 years now?
At 12 least? Or more, yeah, yeah.
So four times.
You know, I looked through, I printed out a list of the more notorious inmates there. And I guarantee you 99% of the people in this country have never heard of Richard. But they've heard of anybody that's been around a while. Zacchaeus Massari, Ramzi Youssef, the Unabomber. All the rest of it. Ted Kaczynski. Then you have the people
who committed
espionage and whatnot. I read this list and it's like, these people murdered multiple people, committed acts of terrorism. And Richard killed one person, wounded another, escaped three times, and that's his crime. And then, of course, like we discussed, what his lawyer did to him, branding him as a dangerous criminal.
Yeah.
Explain that. Yeah, can you simplify that for us, Sam? How that, like, because that's it's like when I first heard about that, I go, well, what does that mean? You know, labeled a dangerous offender, and Byron said, well, it just means you're never going to get out again. But so, explain that little part of the story, if you would, Sam. Can you?
Let me interject. I have not covered American crime stories in detail, but in Canada, prisoners too are declared dangerous offenders, and yes, it does mean they're never going to get out. To get that label, there first must be a whole process, a number of hearings that go on for months. But down there, that never happened. McNair appears in court. He tells his judge, he tells his lawyer that he will plead guilty. The lawyer gives that statement to the judge, and then the lawyer says, "And by the way, he's agreed to be a dangerous offender." What? So McNair does it, never heard of that before. He said, no, I haven't. And the judge tells him, you take that up with your lawyer. Well, by that point, he's screwed. So, yes, his lawyer did throw him under the bus. His lawyer was a former prosecutor. And I'll leave it at that.
But it's even more than being thrown under the bus. It's like being accused of something or being fingered for something that wasn't true. Like, I mean, it's more than just walking away from somebody or neglect. You know, it's an out-and-out lie, really. Wouldn't you say, Sam?
Yeah. Yeah, it's false. Sam, how it works in Canada with a dangerous offender label, that is not agreed to easily in court. They never agree to it. There has to be a hearing to determine if he is indeed a dangerous offender. McNair would have never been declared a dangerous offender had they had gone through the proper procedure. But his lawyer threw him under the bus and said, yep, my client agrees to it. And the judge winked and said, yep, that's it. So that's why they gave him, quote, 30 years for break and enters. It's a cover for the dangerous offender label. The documentary doesn't get into that, by the way.
I can't for the life of me, Sam, figure out, you know, maybe because I'm not involved to that deep in law enforcement, so maybe you can help me here, but I have no idea why a lawyer would do that to a client. Do you have any idea what the reason for that would be?
So, Byron, this attorney, was he a local Minot attorney?
Yes, he was. He was. He started off as a prosecutor, what we in Canada would call a crown prosecutor. So he went after the bad guys, but then he switched. He became a defense lawyer, which is the other side of the fence. And as I was driving there to meet him, I was in a police cruiser driven by the sheriff, Vern Irk, And Vern is praising this guy.
Oh, sorry.
And right away, that's unusual. Police do not praise defense lawyers. But he was.
Nope.
He was saying Richard Thomas, he's a very funny guy. You know, he told me the other day that he was, one of his clients was charged with making crystal meth. And now he manufacturing crystal meth, and now he wants me to manufacture a defense. Well, defense lawyers would never share that with a policeman. Never, never. And but here he is throwing his own client under the bus. Not only did he throw in the dangerous offender label, he also called behind McNair's back when he was put away in a penitentiary in Bismarck, North Dakota, telling the people, the assistant warden down there, whom he knew, that this guy is going to kill again and he's going to escape. So when McNair arrived at this penitentiary, he has a guard walking behind him all the time. And he's in laundry detail, which is pretty harmless. So another con had said, what are you doing? Why are you following this inmate? And he said, because he's dangerous. He's a killer. And the guy said, yeah, so am I. So are most of the people here, buddy. But, you know, it was a mystery to McNair until the lawyer admitted to me that he had made those phone calls to the penitentiary. And then Richard McNair, when the lights went on, and said, aha, that's why that happened. So his lawyer, yes, had thrown him under the bus. But his lawyer was, in my view, part of the old boys club in North Dakota.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I had an incident when I was stationed there that I'd cashed my paycheck at the credit union, and I got like 1940s $20 bills. And my friend and I were going to Kmart. That's the guy's memorial service I'm going to next weekend who'd passed. We go into Kmart, and I was buying something, and the dumb cashier thought that I'd counterfeited these bills. So they called store security, and I'm looking at this girl's like, are you people that stupid? You think I'm going to counterfeit a 40-plus-year-old bill? So they get me back in the office, and they call, I can't remember, it was Minot PD or Ward County. But the sergeant that came out and knew me, he's like, Sammy, what's going on? I said, tell these idiots I'm a cop out on the airbase. And he says, yeah, you guys really stepped in the doo-doo this time. And I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go right back to base. I'm going to tell my commander. He's going to call the base commander, and he's going to put this store off limits. And immediately, they were all hat in hand polite. I said, no, this is bull crap. It's only because I'm in the Air Force that you're doing this. And I said, seriously, who's going to counterfeit a 40-plus-year-old bill? So I go back. My commander was livid. They put that place off limits to all the Air Force for 90 days. So they lost a boatload of business. But it was that old boy network. They did not like us. And, you know, my dad, he knew people who were prosecuting attorneys that flipped them, became defense attorneys. And they represented drug dealers. But they did it. And attorney, their job's to defend the client, not stab him in the back. So there had to be some gain for him. And you know, I always tell people, you know, you follow the trail, follow the money trail. You know, what could Richard have done to this guy to get him to turn against him like that? Unless the county, the state was offering, hey, you know, we'll do this, we'll do that. It's crazy. And then for him to sit there and break to the cops about his clients, you don't do that.
Well, the word,
you know, and it's a shame that Richard. I'm looking on the, you know, the list of people, and there's one fellow that Harold Nicholson, CIA officer, convicted espionage. He only got a 23 year sentence. He's going to be released in 26 November of 2023. And yet Richard's got exactly no known date when he'll be eligible for parole. And I mean, when was that we had, we did write to the parole board? How many years ago was that, Byron?
Yeah, it's a few years ago, but he's not eligible to even get a shot at parole for another 6-8 years. I'm not sure now, but he's that's true. That's what they said.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I was racking my brain today. I don't even think I got a
because I actually typed the letter up. I think I sent you a draft first to see if it was okay. They never even responded to me.
Yeah, they did to me. I would support him for parole. I would not support him at the time of the murder, which was a third of a century ago, but that has changed. And sometimes when I give talks, public talks at universities, I'm asked about that. If anyone has heard any of my broadcasts on prisoners, the odd one will say, well, you seem to be a bit more sympathetic to them than the average reporter. And I say, yeah, that's true. And why is that? And I said, well, it's because of a book I read when I was a kid. I might have been 12 or 13. Mm. It was written by a group of guys who turned their lives around. They were scumbags. Some were killers. But then nonetheless, they were pushing humanity in the right direction. And I was impressed by that. I read that book, in fact, twice. And at one point, the students will say, what's the name of the book? And I said, it's called The Holy Bible. That's true. And in Canada, we had a former head of the National Parole Board here was a convicted killer. He spent time for a murder in a penitentiary in Saskatchewan. He got out, turned his life around, became a parole board member, and was good at it. He was tougher than most of the inmates asking for parole, and they made him head of the parole board.
Hmm.
So, you know, people can turn their lives around. But in this case, I don't know if that's going to happen because of the politics there of the old boys club. But also, I think this documentary series on McNair doesn't do it justice. I wouldn't rate it as passable. I would give it a 3 out of 10. I give him credit for some of the photos, archival footage and that. But, I mean, they deliberately went out of their way to exclude me from it, even though they said I was involved. I didn't have final say in spite of that promise. I didn't know who they were interviewing, and when I did bring it up, they just ignored it, even though they acknowledged one was a big mistake. Well, if it's a big mistake, you would, and that's the woman from Calgary, why would you have her there?
Hmm. Yeah.
I don't get that.
Well, I don't know if Richard is ever going to get out or not, but like for me, like the thing is, I don't know, part of me, and I don't want to sound like a kumbaya moment here for you guys, but it seems to me if there's any hope for humanity, redemption has to be part of the deal. And if you never let a guy out of prison, there's never that possibility of redemption. I mean, look, America loves a story of somebody who rises to the top, you know, and then gets knocked down. But even better when he rises back to the top again by making, you know, a redemption or redeeming himself, you know. So do you think Richard will ever get out? And do you agree with that thing about redemption, Sam?
Honestly, I hope and pray he does. But the one thing about Minot, tell you how vindictive they were against the Air Force. If you went downtown and wrote a bad check, the vendor would not call you up and say, hey, Joe, your check bounced, come in here. They go down to the sheriff's department and swear out a warrant. And we had what was called exclusive jurisdiction. So the police just couldn't come on and say, hey, I'm going over here. We had to escort them. And they would come on once or twice a month with a boatload of warrants. And the deputy sheriffs were like, this is bull crap. You know, we're going to go take this guy in and lock him up for bouncing a $10 check. And that's how vindictive they were over something petty like a bounce check. So think about a murder and the wounding that Richard did, you know, how they're going to be. But, you know, like you said, Steve, how's he going to prove that he has redeemed himself unless he's allowed to be released, even to like a work camp or something, and get out of that supermax environment? Let him go someplace where, you know, he can go out and work in the fields instead of being locked up 23 hours a day.
Or even give keynote speeches or something, you know, give lectures or, you know, anything. You know, they keep saying, you know, it's such a shame he's, you know, like he was so talented and all this. And if only he'd have put that to good. Well, why not give him a chance? You know, like, isn't there something he could do, think?
He did that in North Dakota. You know, he talked to kids. He did like the scared straight things. And, you know, I told Byron yesterday, we had a case here in the county I live. There was a young, pretty little girl driving down the road, texting and driving, hits and kills a guy on a motorcycle. She gets probation. Now, I don't care if the guy was a Hells Angels or a pagan or the CEO of Amazon. She took a human life.
she knowingly got behind a wheel, was distracted, and killed somebody. And yet we have drug dealers here in Baltimore City that shoot and kill each other, and they'll get 35, 40 years. Now, they won't do 35 or 40 years, but you know, where's the fairness in that? You still take a human life. You know, it's irregardless. But you know, Richard's been in there so long, and my gut tells me that the federal government is just going to keep him in there. They, you know, he made them look bad, and that's it. And it's a shame. You know, there's people, like I mentioned, that guy that committed espionage for the Central Intelligence Agency. He's going to be getting out in a year and a half. And Richard's still going to be in there. He's in there with people that, you know, committed far more heinous crimes than he ever did. You know, it'd have been different if he got out and kept going on murder sprees and whatnot. But it's a shame.
It seems odd. It really does. You know, I mean, it seems odd that he's being spoken in the same breath as you say, the shoe bomber and the Unabomber in the same prison complex, you know, but.
Yeah, well, the important thing is that something is done, and it's done without malice. And I'm not hoping that anyone would make a hero out of McNair. I don't know anyone who would ever say that.
No.
You know, but I think you cannot vilify someone over speculation. And you know, he gets out, yeah, he's dangerous. Well, hell, he was on the run for a year and a half, 2 years. Never physically hurt anyone.
No, he never.
Why would you say that?
Not a personal problem.
Yeah, you know, I'm sorry. I mean, that's the problem I have with that. When they take a lot of liberty with the license and say what they want to say, and they can't back it up. But I'm especially annoyed at reporters, even former reporters, try to take credit for information they didn't get. I mean, they're in the business, they're following police news releases, good for them. But when they read the book, they sit back and quote from it as if they have inside knowledge of it, and they don't. And worse yet, the producers are telling them what to say. Yeah, that, I don't know, I'll never get over that one.
And when I first watched that first episode, I thought, okay, this is going to be a series. And I asked Byron yesterday, okay, so who's going to be the next escapee? He said they're not. And I was like, why? Why would they go do a four-part so-called documentary on Richard? And I mean, maybe it was just my dumb country self anticipating, oh, wow, this is going to be a series. I wonder who's going to be next.
No. All four parts.
Cool Hand Luke.
All
four segments were invented. But they didn't, in my view, did not start it. Right? McNair is not known for a murder, and he's not known for escaping handcuffs. Yeah, that's what has not made him famous. He's famous because he shipped himself out of a penitentiary in a crate. Yeah. That is why he is known around the world. So what do they? How do they start the series with him slipping out of handcuffs? No, you don't. You have him in the crate, fighting to breathe to get out, to get some attention. And from what I've seen of the numbers, and this is from three different sources, the series is not grabbing a huge audience. So I suppose that's one benefit.
Well, the way I think I don't know, maybe you guys would be on the same page as me. Byron says 3 out of 10, but I was going to go like, I mean, we're not, you know, Siskel and Ebert kind of thing. But I mean, I was thinking 3 out of 5 was the way I felt about it, because I liked it, but I didn't love it. And the biggest disappointment for me is I didn't love it, you know. I mean, even if they could have filmed that low speed chase, you know, we could have all related to that, guys, you know.
Yeah.
You know, that low speed chase in Camelton, you know, like that would have been a cool little way to kind of end it. But I don't know. I just I get the impression we all wished we would have seen a little more in that four part series. What do you think?
I kind of felt cheated. You know, it's like when you walk out of a movie and you go, God, that sucked. You know, I want my money back. It was horrible. And, you know, just especially the last half of the fourth episode, it was like, geez, what is this? Just pile on Richard. Let's just beat Richard to a pulp. And, you know, I knew Marty Edwards, the OSI agent. As I told Byron, I didn't know him all that well because we worked fairly close with the OSI there at Minot. And, you know, my memory is for crap now. I blame it on my heart attack and the sleep apnea. But, you know, it just, to see people that he never hurt, I mean, he was a confidential informant for the OSI. And then all of a sudden it's like, wow, he went out and committed these crimes. Oh, he's a scumbag. They forget all the drug cases that he helped bring to them.
Exactly.
And, you know, everybody's just turning on him. It's kind of sad. I mean, geez, the guy, he's screwed up. He's been in jail for 30 plus years. He's paid his dues. They're not even giving him a chance at redemption.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
You know, like I read in that article about they're supposed to transfer prisoners after 3 years. So send him to another prison. Let him put him back in North Dakota and let him, you know, deal with that there.
That's true. Maybe another prison system, he might have a different chance too, you know, like there may be less politics in that region. I don't want to get too deep into it and get polarizing, but you never know. Sometimes just a change of location can make a difference, you know. Well, guys, I want to thank you for... Go ahead, Byron. Sorry.
An interesting chat. I appreciate you taking the time, Steve. You know, you were on the ground in Campbellton when the story broke.
Yeah.
I wish I'd known you then. You could have tipped me off.
Oh, I wish. You know, it's funny. I guess that's something probably somebody in law enforcement or security or whatever, Sam, could kind of say, like, geez, in hindsight, if I'd have known this, you know, in real time. But, I mean, like, you might find it interesting. I mean, the fact that I would say under a mile away from where Richard was when he was captured, you know, and ironically, I could have walked the same streets of Campbellton while he did and not know. I doubt that I did, but that was possible. But I mean, like, I knew exactly when they described the story of where he was captured, I knew exactly where they meant. They go, okay, you go up Gallant Drive and then you turn right and you come around here and there's an opening to the Sugarloaf and there it is, you know? Like, he went in there, he ran in there. Did he turn left or right, Byron? You know, like, that's all I needed to know, like, in the inside. So I've always felt like I was close to the story without being close or part of the story, you know, like, and then, of course, when Byron wrote his article for the Tribune and then went on to write his books, you know, it was such a pleasure to have him on the podcast. But Sam, I appreciate you joining us from Maryland and giving us a little more insight into Richard as well as a person.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Pleasure.
Yeah. Very, very insightful. And also I appreciated, you know, hearing you were the only person that seemed to be that didn't say the word betrayal, you know, like, and these guys seem to be personally betrayed by everything that McNair did. Anyway, it was nice getting a kind of an unbiased, you know, distant fly on the wall kind of look at it, but still having known Richard. And it's nice to know that you're now in contact with him, too. So down the road, we may get other parts of the story as well. So
is Campbellton now known as the town where Richard McNair was captured?
In part, yeah.
No.
I guess it's included in Wikipedia now. Although when the American media picked up on the fact that Richard Lee McNair was captured, they described it as a town 200 miles north of Maine.
200 miles north of Maine. Ah, yeah, there's just that one town in the middle of Canada over there.
Whatever. It's an American story, so they wanted the attention.
Oh, there would have been so much color. There's so many gems they could have had in Campbellton, you know, like there was twice he almost broke into a car dealership, changed his mind. He looked at Central Garage, remember that we talked about that, Byron, in Atholville?
Yes,
and then
But
there was people working on repairs or something in there. So Central Garage could have lost the vehicle that night. And then the other car dealership out on the highway, I think it's a Kia or something, found the door open, went... I'm telling your story now, but I mean, like, you know, you talk about it in the book, didn't you? Or did you just tell me in the podcast? I can't remember now. It's been so long.
No, it's in the book. Yeah. He's checking out the doors. And, oh, my goodness, his door is open. Salespeople had left the door open to a dealership, even though it was closed. The dealership was closed. The door was side door was wide open. So McNair returns to grab his vehicle. And who pulls up? His sales manager. So he had to pretend he's looking at the cars. And he said, well, by the way, your door is open there. And I said, oh, my goodness, okay. So they go and lock it. So he turns out McNair is a good Samaritan.
Yeah, it's all part of his psychopathic behavior, right, Sam? Right. Yeah. Thanks.
Only in Canada.
No kidding, yeah. Thanks for joining us from Maryland, Sam. I appreciate it. And Byron, thank you for joining us from Edmonton.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
And you as well from Edmonton, Byron.
Well, I'll say goodbye to you too. And thank you, Sam, for expressing your opinions on that insight. And to you, Steve, for taking the time to talk with us. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
All right. Take care.
All right, you too. Bye.
Thanks, guys. Well, I gotta be honest. A couple of years ago, when Byron was on the show, the contract had been signed and work had begun on the TV docudrama. I, like a lot of other people back in New Brunswick, were quite excited. I expected film crews back home, maybe a few people would be hired locally as either temporary film crew or maybe as actors in reenactments. This would have lifted a community and had a big impact for generations to come. Local journalists from the Tribune could have been featured, or at least acknowledged. Maybe city officials. Somebody. Didn't happen. It's like the series spends 4 hours following McNair's journey, and then it's wrapped up kind of like, oh yeah, he was captured in Campbellton. RCMP guys. You know, and that's it. I mean, he had been to the Campbellton area at least 3 times, an RCMP officer had tailed his van just a few days earlier, and then there's that fake driver's license calling him Troy Snyder. In fact, RCMP called him an effing liar, saying, "You're not McNair. It says here you're Troy Snyder." All of that was left out of the docudrama. And here's another thing. I fail to see how some of the so-called experts would lend credibility to the docudrama. I mean, a crime blogger who wrote a story for the Calgary Herald about Richard Lee McNair's sightings that were inaccurate. He was never in Calgary. And then there's that former CNN correspondent, who, by the way, is attacked online for bias coverage and mocked by Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. Then there's that crime psychologist who's never met McNair and evaluates him from his letters to Byron. Does that bring credibility to the story? The thing is, no matter how you slice it, your best chance at telling the Richard Lee McNair story in a credible way is through Byron Christopher. Like it or not, he's the gatekeeper because McNair won't talk to anyone else in the media. Now, I know for a fact that Byron verified a lot of details and statements McNair made because Byron meticulously visited the actual locations across North America. And on the scoreboard, McNair is more accurate than law enforcement and in many cases the mainstream media when it comes to verifiable facts. Byron's book, The Man Who Mailed Himself Out of Jail, also gives you a better sense of who Richard McNair is, and more importantly, who he was. Neither a saint nor a monster. He's not a hero in his story, but after reading the book, you'll see maybe he's not the only bad guy either. I don't know that you'll get that impression from The Prison Breaker, but watch it and see. And I gotta tell you, it's not the conversation I pictured with Byron Christopher a year ago, but maybe that adds to the story. And the story will continue. And that's our show. Thank you so much for listening. You can listen to all our past shows anytime you like, including episodes with Byron Christopher, by visiting downhomecorner.com. If you'd like to hire me to voice your business's next commercial, video, tutorial, or explainer video, drop me a line, steve@downhomecorner.com. Byron's book is updated frequently, and it's available at amazon.ca. You can also check out his latest ventures and writings at byronchristopher.org. Please like and share this show on social media. Till next time, for Down Home Corner, I'm Steve Bijou saying everybody has a story, and we are all connected.